Welcome to the Functional Medicine Podcast with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay. We're coming to you from McMinn Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, where Dr. McMinn is an integrative and functional MD, and Lindsay Matthews is a registered nurse and IIN certified health coach. In this podcast, we'll be discussing the latest information on a wide range of topics in the field of functional medicine, which looks for the root cause of disease, and integrative medicine, which incorporates both conventional and alternative therapies. Our overall goal is to help you be the best that you can be in mind, body, and spirit. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without approval from your personal doctor. And now, on to the show with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay.
Welcome back to the Functional Medicine Podcast. This is Dr. McMinn from the beautiful city of Birmingham, Alabama, one of the best-kept secrets in the South. We took a bit of a break since Coach Lindsay had a beautiful baby girl, little Miss Mary Ellen Matthews, but we're back full steam ahead now, and I'm super excited to have a guest today on the show, especially someone I know so well and think the world of, who's so bright and articulate. This is our guest, Christina Pierpaoli Parker. Christina is a fifth-year PhD candidate in the field of clinical geropsychology at the University of Alabama. Her research and clinical interests explore the intersection of older adults' physical and psychological health, focusing on a chronic health condition such as insomnia. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Christina's work has been published in the journals Aging and Health, Sex and Marital Therapy, and The Clinical Gerontologist. She has presented at International Aging, Health, and Psychology conferences, and she has a blog on Psychology Today, which you should definitely check out. There are so many topics Christina could expertly elaborate on today, but we're going to pick her amazing brain on the very important topic of insomnia, which is right in the center of her wheelhouse. So good morning to you, Christina.
Good morning, Dr. Yes. McMinn. Thanks for having me.
Oh, a warm and enthusiastic welcome to you to the Functional Medicine Podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah. So let's get started. You know, I have a nickname for all the things on my pyramid of wellness, and you might want to check that out. Go to our website at functionalmedicinepodcast.com. You'll see the pyramid there, and it has all the fundamentals like nutrition, hydration, exercise, restorative sleep, and blah, blah, blah. But sleep is the only one that actually has two nicknames. I call it the magic elixir because it can fix just about anything, and I also call it the linchpin. So if you ever have driven a trailer and you didn't have the linchpin and the trailer falls off, so same thing, if you don't get a good night's sleep, eventually everything will fall off. It affects just about everything, heart disease, brain health, immune function, cancer, obesity, mood. Oh my gosh, the list just keeps going on and on. So Christina's area of emphasis is something called CBTI, which stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia. So, Christina, let's start with you just by telling us what is CBTI.
Yeah, and I want to back up for a second and mention that I agree with your moniker, the magic elixir.
Yeah.
When we think about some of the old wives' tales about sleep, no one has ever told you to stay awake on it.
Yeah, wisdom
always relies on sleeping on it.
That's right.
CBTI, known as Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, is an evidence-based treatment for the management and cure of insomnia. Typically involves about 4 to 8 sessions in a clinic with a health psychologist who specializes in behavioral sleep medicine. Sometimes there are more sessions, sometimes there are fewer. And this treatment emphasizes the cognitive, so the thinking components that go into the initiation and maintenance of insomnia, as well as the behavioral, so the things that we do or don't do that can maintain sleep dysfunction. And over the course of this 4 to 8 treatment protocol, which of course gets tailored to the individual, patients learn relaxation strategies, sleep hygiene strategies, something called stimulus control, when indicated, are put on a sleep restriction or sleep compression schedule, as well as cognitive skills for reframing some of the distortions or unhelpful thoughts and beliefs that they may have about their sleep. And this is typically done in a medical setting. So for example, the clinic in which I work is embedded in a sleep medicine clinic. And increasingly, that's the model where a health psychologist or a sleep psychologist will be embedded in a medical center and can provide behavioral adjunctive treatments to traditional medical interventions for sleep issues.
Wow, that's a handful. So it seems like a lot of organizations like the American Family Practice Organization, for instance, are recommending CBTI as the primary initial thing you do for sleep, right?
Absolutely. And the reason for that is because the evidence points to a few factors. One, when we kind of compare hypnotic medication to a behavioral intervention, so said differently, when we compare things like Lunesta and Ambien to the actual effectiveness of something like CBTI, the effects of CBTI are not only subjectively preferred by patients, meaning that they like it better than taking medication, but the effectiveness is more durable, meaning it lasts. It lasts beyond the time period in which a traditional medication might work. So that's a really important thing, especially for functional medicine practitioners, because we're always trying to explore the root cause and trying to intervene at that kernel. And the beautiful thing about CBTI is that it tackles the underlying mechanics, cognitions, behaviors, attitudes, and beliefs towards sleep that can maintain sleep dysfunction. So the benefit of CBTI is that it has no side effects beyond good ones. It's economical and brief and very parsimonious. It doesn't require a year of psychotherapy. When it's done effectively, it can be done in as few as 3 sessions. Wow. And the effects of it are durable. And unlike medications or Z drugs, hypnotic medications, we don't believe that it predicts the onset of cognitive impairment, doesn't increase the risk of falls, doesn't increase the risk of metabolic dysfunction, or cause the traditional hangover effects that many, many users of those medications describe experiencing.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to ask. I mean, it's so easy to take some Klonopin or Ambien, and a lot of my patients come in on those things. So I think you just gave us a good list of why not to do that. Right?
Well, let me be clear. I don't want to demonize those medications. First of all, as a PhD candidate and a non-medical practitioner, I'm not even sure I'm allowed to have an opinion about those things. And there are certainly circumstances in which a benzodiazepine or a sleep medication might be indicated in the case, for example, of an acute insomnia episode where someone might receive some life-changing information about their health status and then can't sleep. So benzodiazepines or Z drugs and hypnotic medications do have a place in the short term, but don't really serve as best options for long-term interventions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I had a patient just last week. She was having a manic episode and had not slept for days. And I felt like, certainly CBTI would not help her sleep that night, right? And so, we did some medications, and I think ultimately it did help her.
There are some features of CBTI that do have acute effectiveness. And when I say that, I mean there are features of it that you can practice that really do work quickly. Mm-hmm. And one example is a guided relaxation technique. The one that we use in our clinic over at UAB involves 3 components: diaphragmatic breathing, autogenic phrases, and progressive muscle relaxation. And this is something that I teach patients to use if they're wanting to hasten their sleep onset latency, or if they wake up in the middle of the night and can't return to sleep, or if they're feeling anxious throughout the day and need to de-escalate. So the downside of CBTI, to the extent that there is one, is that it is more gradual. This isn't something that you can literally do overnight, though there are components of it, specifically relaxation, that can exert rather immediate effects on the patient.
Yeah, you mentioned the sleep latency. Tell our audience, what is sleep latency?
Yeah, sleep latency is how long it takes for you to fall asleep. And there are some research studies that question what that magic number is, but in general, the clinical wisdom is 15 to 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. Some will say 15 to 20, but when you're working with older populations, 15 to 30 is the appropriate amount of time for someone to fall asleep. If it's taking you longer than that to fall asleep, that's where you work with a clinician or another health provider mm-hmm. to implement CBTI strategies to hasten that.
Yeah, and what are your thoughts on the issue of a prolonged sleep latency, or if you get up in the middle of the night and you can't get back to sleep, do you get out of bed and go do some light reading, or do you just stay there and keep trying? What do you do?
Yeah, and this is one of the tenets of CBTI, and in fact, when we sort of partition out the different elements of CBTI, relaxation, cognitive reframing, sleep restriction, compression, and stimulus control, the two most effective standalone interventions include stimulus control and sleep restriction. And stimulus control refers to getting out of the bed when you cannot sleep or fall asleep within that 15 to 30 minute time period. Mm-hmm. And there's a very basic behavioral explanation for this, which I'm going to explain right now. So listeners, listen up, because this probably is one of the most important components. So one question we'll ask patients, or two questions we'll ask patients upon intake into our clinic is, how many hours of sleep do you think you're getting? And how many hours are you spending in your bed? So total sleep time, TST, and time in bed, TIB. People with a prototypical insomnia profile tend to spend more time in bed awake than asleep. Not uncommonly, for example, I will ask a patient, how many hours of sleep do you estimate you get nightly? And they reply with 4, 5. Okay? Problematic, certainly. How many hours do you spend in your bed? Upwards of 8, sometimes 10. Mm-hmm. And the problem, of course, has to do with how your brain encodes the time it spends in bed. If over repeated iterations over years, decades, you are spending more time awake in your bed than asleep, the brain begins to see the bed as a cue for wakefulness rather than for sleep. So every time you read in bed, watch TV in bed, worry in bed, toss and turn in bed, your brain reinforces the bed as a cue for activity rather than for sleep, because it thinks, this is the place I worry. This is the place I read. This is the place where I do my work. This is the place where I eat. The only thing the bed ought to be used for is the three S's: sleep, sex, and sickness. Everything else needs to happen outside of the bed. So practically and clinically, what this means is when you notice you're having difficulty falling asleep or returning to sleep within 15 to 30 minutes, the protocol is to get out of the bed, go into another room, and do something relaxing but not stimulating. And this typically will include something that is mindless, rote, and relaxing. So reading a book, folding laundry, practicing a guided relaxation technique, prayer, doing a word search or a crossword puzzle. This is not the time to light a cigarette, to drink alcohol, watch TV, play with your phone, make a to-do list, or do something that is activating or stimulating. And the rationale for this is, when you are able to outsource activity into another room, your brain extinguishes the association of bed with activity and restores the association of the bed with sleep, because as part of this protocol, you will only return back to the bed when you notice those symptoms of sleepiness. And at this point in the clinic, I like to differentiate between feeling sleepy and feeling tired. Many patients, as I'm sure you know, will tell you, you know, Dr. McMahon, I feel so tired. And that's actually a really important thing to unpack, because feeling tired refers to this psychological state of depletion. Tired is how we feel after a long day of work, when we feel spent, like we've given ourselves away. Sleepy, on the other hand, is distinctly behavioral, meaning your body tells you in very clear, unequivocal ways that it needs to go to bed. How? Well, it's the heaviness in your eyes. It's the heaviness in your body. It's your head bobbing. So as part of the stimulus control protocol, you only want to return to bed when you notice those symptoms of sleepiness. And in doing that, you restore the association of bed with sleep. And over time, over repeated iterations of practicing stimulus control, the bed returns back to a cue for sleep rather than activity. And to explain this more elegantly, I like to tell patients, imagine I told you to sit at the table until hunger came. What would your reaction be to that? Well, that's completely unreasonable. You wouldn't force yourself to sit at a table until hunger came. Instead, you'd go off and do things and expend some energy to build up an appetite and only return to the kitchen or restaurant when you felt hungry. The same analogy applies to sleep. Why would you stay in bed, forcing sleep to come? You would get out of the bed per stimulus control and only return when you felt sleepy.
Well, it sounds great. However, this is not meant to push back, but in the real world, I find a lot of patients claim that I'm a, quote, night person, end quote, I'm using area. So, and they say, I get a second wind. They might be kind of wired but tired, but they find that they don't get sleepy till 2 in the morning. And I'm well aware of that whole concept of circadian rhythms. And so
Absolutely.
These night people, even if you get 8 hours sleep, if you get it out of sync with circadian rhythms, there's a price to be paid for that vis-a-vis dementia and heart disease and obesity and all that kind of stuff. So therefore, what do you do if you're kind of you're wired to be a night guy you just don't get sleepy? And so can you somehow proactively kind of go after it and try to make yourself sleepy?
Sure. It's an excellent, excellent question. And what you're talking about is circadian rhythm disorder.
Right.
And this actually is the area of expertise of my mentor, Dr. Justin Thomas, who founded the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Clinic at UAB. And in fact, this is such an important contextual factor that we have to ask this upon intake. And one question we'll ask is about your chronotype. So chronotype is basically this question of, are you a night owl or are you a lark? Are you an early riser, an early bird, or are you a combination, which we call an intermediate chronotype? Most people in the population tend to scatter into that middle group, intermediate. So not quite a morning person, not quite an evening person, somewhere in the middle. But then there are certainly others who describe themselves as night owls who get this second wind at 2 a.m. People who are night owls, we describe as having a delayed circadian profile, and early birds are described as advanced circadian types.
I heard a really interesting lecture one time. The guy was saying that the night people tend to have more ADD, more depression, more heart attacks. We die younger. So, yeah, that's not good. So,
well,
I mean, if I could check the box and be a morning guy, I would definitely be that. But I worked 20 years of night shifts in the ER, and I think I was always kind of a night guy. I preferred nights. But I finally realized that that's taking a toll on my health, and so I got out of it. But still, to this day, it's I don't get sleepy at night. My wife, 9 o'clock, boom, she's gone.
Well, and so we have to really be very tentative and careful, because a lot of the research pointing to the deleterious effects of a delayed circadian rhythm rely on epidemiological studies that notoriously don't account for major confounding variables. And I just want to pause and recognize that correlation does not equal causation. On average, shift work does predict metabolic dysfunction, cognitive dysfunction, interpersonal dysfunction.
Pure badness.
But we need to always think about it on an individual level. Data in general rely on averages and means, and we know that there is significant inter and intra-individual variability. That said, the World Health Organization recently deemed shift work as a probable carcinogen.
Yeah, for sure.
Because there have been significant epidemiological, and I'm not sure there have been any experimental studies, you couldn't do that, but that demonstrate, for example, that shift workers like flight attendants, for example, have higher incidence of cancer and metabolic dysfunction than people who don't. So, but to go back to your question, what do we do about this clinically, right? Because sometimes what looks like insomnia might actually be a circadian rhythm disorder. And the treatments for that, while similar, are distinct. So if you find that you go to bed a lot earlier than most people or a lot later than most people, and that causes you significant distress and impairment, right? Because those are the two factors as a psychologist in training I look for. Does this particular phenomenon cause you distress? Does it bother you? And does it impair your life? And for many people with advanced circadian rhythm, so people who fall asleep really early, they can't meaningfully participate in social activity. These are the people who go to bed at 5 or 6 and then wake up at, you know, 2 a.m. That, given how our society functions, doesn't serve most people. But if you find that your sleeping pattern is causing distress and impairment, whether in terms of delayed or advanced circadian rhythm, you work with a sleep psychologist who will use something called chronotherapy, so time therapy and light therapy. Just in brief, for people with advanced circadian rhythms, so people who go to bed early, what we do is systematically expose them to more light later in the day for longer periods of time to shift their pattern.
How do you do that?
Well, you work with a sleep psychologist. You can design a light exposure schedule. Some people get light boxes. We also really focus on increasing daytime energy expenditure. So really getting busy throughout the day, emphasizing our energy, kind of like a money model. The idea is if you spend a lot of energy in the day, you're not going to have it later. And so for many people who feel excessive daytime fatigue, what we'll do is paradoxically get them moving when they feel fatigued to build up that sleep pressure and therefore delay their bedtime. With people who have delayed circadian rhythm, so the night owls, the people who struggle to go to bed early, we kind of have to do the opposite. We have to play with light in a different direction and also potentially use melatonin supplementation earlier in the day to push their sleep time up. This is really difficult to do clinically because a lot of the timing of both the light and melatonin will depend on dips in blood pressure, dips in melatonin, dips in core body temperature. And we don't have the technologies to do that accurately and well. So those get a bit more difficult, but clinically, it's very important to parse out insomnia pathology versus a chronotype issue.
Yeah, interesting. I think I read something recently about people, for instance, night people like me, if you use a light box early in the morning, then you'll be able to get to sleep better at night. Mm-hmm. So I've actually been doing that recently.
Yep. And another thing, it's in the opposite direction.
When I get that second wind, I really try to just resist the temptation to do stimulating things. I try to kind of, turn off the computer and the iPad and the iPhone and all those stimulating things and maybe read a book.
I think that's really great. Yeah. And practicing, so I'll teach patients how to practice relaxation. Right. And just to back up and to inform your listeners, what's the deal with light and stimulation? Why do we care about that?
And please comment on that, but also in the context of iPhones, iPads, computers, and the light in your eyes that you get from those things late at night.
Absolutely. So, yeah, absolutely. So why do we care about it? Well, you know, there's blue light and there's white light. And when we're talking about light in the context of sleep, almost always we're talking about blue light, which is believed to exert the most kind of devastating effects on your sleep. Basic, you know, neurophysiology. So your brain secretes melatonin in darkness, right? So when it's dark, your brain produces melatonin, a hormone that stimulates drowsiness. In light, that hormone production gets interrupted. So that's why we really want to prevent light exposure 2 to 3 hours before bed, because messages from your retina send signals to your suprachiasmatic nucleus.
Ooh.
Which, yeah,
scary.
I'm talking dirty, everyone. Sends, you know, messages to your suprachiasmatic nucleus, which regulates you know, the production of melatonin. So light exposure before bed interrupts the production of melatonin. Darkness facilitates the production of melatonin. Now, I can already kind of imagine some of the pushback. Well, you know, Dr. McMinn, Christina, I watch TV before bed all the time.
Yeah, I hear
that. And
all
I fall asleep. Yeah. Or I could have my iPhone in my hand and fall asleep. That's not the question. The question is not, will I fall asleep? Certainly, because sleep is a drive like hunger. Your body will experience sleep in the same way it will experience hunger. The better question is, what does it do to your sleep quality? And there, some studies have demonstrated that an hour of light exposure before bed can delay the onset into deep sleep by up to 3 hours. So it's not a question of if I will sleep, it's a question of how will it affect my sleep. And we believe that it affects entry into one of the most restorative stages of sleep, stage 3 and stage 4.
Yeah, right. I remember years ago, I read a really interesting study. It was from Harvard. They took a bunch of people, actually divided them into two groups. One group, they both read the same group, the same book. One read it from an iPad, one read it from a book. Mm-hmm. And then they put them in a sleep lab and measured sleep architecture, you know,
yep,
where they
right.
look at
right.
deep sleep. And what they found, there was a significant worsening of sleep architecture with people who read from a device.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, I certainly I'm trying to avoid that. Well, tell us about the stages of sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. And unimaginatively, they're called stages 1 through 4 and then REM.
Yeah. And we should come up with different names. We should
really
call it
should come up with
stage
a new
Christina. Sage McMinn, state, whatever.
I love that. A new taxonomy. Yeah, maybe we could involve zodiac signs. That would be interesting. And so that's what we're talking about when we talk about sleep architecture, is the relative time spent in these different stages. And it's called sleep architecture because if you ever look at a polysomnography.
Which is what? No.
The PSG.
It's a piece of paper. When they monitor your sleep, it prints out on a piece of paper, and you can see these like curves that tell you which stage you're in.
Exactly. And what's interesting about that is it almost looks like a skyline.
Inverted.
Yeah, exactly. Inverted skyline. Or just depending on your dysfunction, an actual skyline. And so it looks like buildings sometimes. And that's why it's called sleep architecture, which I think is pretty clever. And so stages 1 through 4 and then REM. REM meaning rapid eye movement, the last stage of sleep. This is sometimes called paradoxical sleep because if you're a normal sleeper, you'll experience atonia, which is basically functional paralysis. You're not really paralyzed, but your body basically stays still and your brain is going 1,000 miles per hour and your eyes are moving.
During REM.
During REM, right. And this is the stage of sleep when we experience dreams.
So if you have dreams, does that mean you got REM sleep?
Yes. Now, it's interesting because there's some people who have suggested that. If you are remembering that you dreamt, you actually haven't gotten deep sleep. Yes, dreams occur in REM, but this idea of dream pride, feeling proud that you've had dreams and that you've remembered it, might be diagnostic, might suggest that perhaps you're not sleeping as deeply as you ought to and that you woke up. So REM is that is the last stage of sleep. We believe that stages 1 through 4 plus REM recycle every 90 minutes. Stages 1 through 2, these are described as the sort of shallow stages of sleep. This is where you kind of begin to lose a bit of consciousness. You fade in and out of consciousness. People will experience hypnagogic hallucinations during this stage. So when your leg twitches or you have that feeling of falling. And as we age, we spend a lot more time in these shallow or superficial stages of sleep, stages 1 and 2, and less time in deeper restorative stages of sleep, stages 3 and 4. And during stages 3 and 4, our body is producing growth hormone. Our bodies are promoting more functional connectivity between different regions of the brain. These are the stages in which memory consolidation occurs. We also know that in these stages of sleep, your body squirts out cerebral spinal fluid to clear out beta amyloid and tau from the brain, which have been implicated in Alzheimer's disease. And so backing up to the light problem, when you expose yourself to light 2 to 3 hours before bed, you are systematically kicking your body out of that deep stage of sleep, or I should say delaying the entry into those stages of sleep 3 and 4 that really exert the most benefit physiologically on the body.
Well, interesting. So as we get older, we have less restorative sleep. Am I hearing you right?
We spend more time in the shallow stages of sleep. That's correct.
And as people get older, there's a greater incidence of
insomnia.
Dementia and Alzheimer's.
Yep.
Is there a connection?
Yeah, we believe that there is a connection. And we're learning more about this. There have been decades of research exploring the connection of sleep deprivation in non-human animals, so in mice and in Drosophila or fruit flies. But most recently, there was a study published in 2018 that demonstrated experimentally the effects of sleep deprivation on the accumulation of beta amyloid in the brain. And so the question was, well, what happens when you sleep deprive people? What does that do to the overall amount of beta amyloid in the brain? And the study demonstrated that after only 5 hours of sleep, participants assigned to a sleep-restricted condition versus an ad libitum or 8-hour sleep period had more beta amyloid in the thalamus and hippocampus. And beta amyloid has been implicated in the onset of dementia and related, or of Alzheimer's and related dementias. And the mechanism through which that happens has to do with the secretion of cerebral spinal fluid. And so at night during stages 3 and 4, your body is squirting out cerebral spinal fluid to clear out beta amyloid in the brain. And when you deprive yourself of sleep, there is less time spent or devoted to that process of beta amyloid clearing. That's why we think there's a very strong relationship between sleep deprivation and the onset of cognitive impairment later in life.
And so are older people just sort of doomed, or is there something they can do to be proactive and improve their stage 3, 4?
By no means doomed, and we have to take a step back and realize that something as complicated as Alzheimer's or dementia really is a multidimensional, multivariate problem related to sleep, related to diet, related to systemic inflammation, other comorbidities, and increasingly attitudes and beliefs towards aging. So no, sleep itself is not sufficient to cause Alzheimer's disease, but the recent evidence has pointed to sleep really as an opportunity to prevent Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So a reframe here is not to be afraid, but to really celebrate sleep as probably one of the most effective behavioral interventions we have to keep our brains and our bodies healthy. So no, this is not fear-mongering. This is not inevitable, but this is an opportunity to start honoring sleep as an investment in the self. And I do want to pause and say, and I've really stolen this from Matthew Walker, who wrote an excellent book called Why We Sleep. And in that, he discusses how two very notorious insomniacs, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, touted how little sleep they needed. And especially during the 80s and, greed is good and that whole, American workaholism stuff was at its highest. That was really celebrated, this idea that sleep was for the weak and we'll sleep when we're dead and there's work to be done. Mm-hmm. Fast forward, these two notorious insomniacs died from complications related to Alzheimer's. Now, again, this is not being propagated to monger fear. This is an opportunity for you to empower yourself to start honoring the power of sleep. Yep. We spend most of our lives asleep. There has to be a reason for it.
Yeah, I have this little thing called the Arch of Wellness. I think it's up on the website. It starts with awareness. You know, the awareness that sleep is important and then the intention to do what you can to do the best you can do to get a good night's sleep.
Absolutely.
Before we leave the sleep stages issue, I want to ask a question. We are a sex-positive clinic, so I can go here. Men get erections at night. Do they get erections during REM sleep? And therefore, if a guy gets a nocturnal erection, does he know he's getting REM sleep?
Interesting. I have absolutely no idea.
That's the first thing I've ever asked you. You didn't know. You should have said, I'm not sure. That's a better thing.
I'm not sure. It's something to research. During REM, we experience atonia, and that's basically to keep us safe because we are flagrantly psychotic in our dreams, and many people will have dreams about being chased or, shooting at someone. And so imagine if we acted out our dreams. Some do, and that's called parasomnia. But for the most part, our body shouldn't be doing too much during REM to keep us safe.
So erections are probably during that stage, because if men acted out their erections, it could be
start
trouble, right?
Humping the mattress.
let me ask you about disrupted sleep.
Sure.
It seems like a lot of people, instead of just coming up to light sleep, they actually wake up.
Yeah.
And so throughout the night, they're waking up. Now, if you wake up, but you get back to sleep, right? So you're still getting your 3-4 restorative sleep. Is that necessarily bad? And especially older people, you have to get up, go to the bathroom. So you get up, you go to the bathroom, you go into the light stage, you get up, you go to the bathroom, come back, go to bed, you get right back to sleep. Is that necessarily that bad?
No. I mean, again, we really want to think about how long is it taking for you to fall asleep. And if it's within 15 to 30 minutes, not to worry. One thing I always like to recommend to older patients, particularly men with prostate issues or even women and men with diabetes and polyuria, really try to, of course, fix your diet, but try to front load your water intake to prevent having to wake up at night. So one thing I will say is have most of your water before 12 in the afternoon to prevent waking up at night. And so when we're thinking about what makes good sleep, we really want to think about a few factors beyond just total sleep time. So one criterion, of course, is how much of it are you actually getting? And the recommended dose of sleep varies according to age. So it's duration of your sleep. It is the consistency of your sleep, so waking up at the same time. It is the consolidation of your sleep, so how continuous versus fragmented it is. It's your subjective attitude and belief towards your sleep, and it's also the regularity of the sleep. So there are a few factors that go into what makes sleep good beyond total sleep time.
Mm-hmm. And some of those things you just mentioned fall into the category called sleep hygiene. Any other major tips for sleep hygiene?
Oh, yeah. Sleep hygiene is actually a pretty controversial subject in the realm of behavioral sleep medicine. People call it the S word. Well, and not because it's bad, it's just because it's been so bastardized, I think. But there are a few canonical, reliable tips that we like to give people. First things first, you really want to increase your energy expenditure throughout the day. Again, going back to this money model, if you spend money over here, you're not going to have it over here later. It's the same thing with our energy. If you're spending a lot of energy in the daytime exercising.
This is physical energy or just thinking?
It's both, but really physical, moving your body. So targeted cardiovascular exercise in the day, walking, running, swimming, sex.
We all have sedentary jobs, right?
And so one of the best and most hygienic behaviors you can do has actually less to do with what you do at night and more to do with what you do in the day, and that is getting busy. So daytime energy expenditure is a major, major thing. The second is really making sure that your bedroom is conducive to sleep. And there are a few factors to consider there. One, is your bedroom dark, right? Going back to the melatonin thing. Is your bedroom quiet? And is it cool? Research has demonstrated that the optimal temperature range for your bedroom should be 62 to 70 degrees. And the reason for that is your body needs, your body's core body temperature ought to drop by 2 to 3 degrees in order for it to maintain and initiate sleep. So keeping your bedroom dark, cool, and quiet are some hygienic things that you can do to promote and optimize your sleep.
Speaking of quiet, what about white noise? Seems like a lot of people like white noise.
And that's an individual difference question. Some people are really light sleepers. Again, that's a canonical change with aging. People become lighter as they spend more time in these superficial stages. So if you're someone who considers themselves a light sleeper, white noise machine is a really, really great tool. Other sensory deprivation techniques help as well, like light face masks, or if you're the opposite, earplugs.
Speaking of keeping the room quiet, I have a real struggle with getting people to get their dogs or cats out of the room.
They love
Fido, right? But all night long, he's scratching for fleas and that chain's rattling and is keeping them awake. But just getting people to get their dog out of the bedroom, oh, it's impossible.
It actually is a really big issue. And the same is true with young children coming into their parents' bedroom. If that's something that you're struggling with, really reaching out to a mental health provider or other health psychologist who can help create a behavioral plan. I do want to back up and say there is another really lovely sleep hygiene behavior that people can try if they're having difficulties initiating sleep, and that is taking a hot shower bath before bed, and that's called passive body heating.
Especially with like Epsom salt.
Well, and so there's
another formula called ancient minerals. Some of my patients
use. People always kind of, I think, roll their eyes when we say Epsom salt, but my attitude is if it's not going to harm you. Experiment with it. And many people find that an Epsom salt with some lavender scent really, really helps them ease into sleep. But what we believe the mechanism of action is has to do with your thermoreceptor. So, you know, when you get in that hot bath, but then you get out and your skin hits that cold air, that plummets your core body temperature, which helps to initiate sleep. So passive body heating about 60 to 90 or 120 minutes before bed has been shown to hasten that sleep onset. Other things include reducing your caffeine, no caffeine after 12, making sure that you're not eating heavy meals, smoking a cigarette, or having alcohol 2 to 3 hours before bed, because those can have thermogenic effects, meaning can increase your core body temperature, which can knock you out of sleep.
Okay, what are your thoughts on naps? That's a controversial subject. I tend to be a nap advocate, but maybe
sure.
A 20, 30-minute power nap. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, a very good question. You're right. It is a bit controversial. And what I'll say is if you are having issues with your sleep, if you do feel like you meet criteria for insomnia and you want to stabilize your sleep, you don't want a nap, right? Because the goal is to save up your money, your credit. So again, if you're spending your sleep over here and we have a total fixed sleep need, you're not going to have it over there later. It's kind of like playing a Tetris game. That said, if you don't have issues with your sleep, if you are having no issues initiating or maintaining sleep, then by all means nap, but only under two conditions: napping consistently, so around the same time every day, and briefly, 15 to 20 minutes. And there is some research to suggest that napping in later life is actually a good idea. But again, only if it's brief and consistent.
You mentioned melatonin. One of the hot things out there these days is the CBD oil. You know anything about that vis-a-vis sleep?
It definitely is an emerging area in the realm of behavioral sleep medicine. We are just now beginning to understand the effects of it. I don't know too much about it beyond there are research studies that are exploring the effects of it. We don't necessarily understand the mechanism of action. Is it that it's actually doing something, or is it placebo and expectancy? of the few research studies I have personally read on the matter, there's less support for actual THC and more support for CBD. And actually what we think is that THC, kind of like alcohol, initially behaves as a depressant, but then as it metabolizes, behaves like a stimulant, which actually and paradoxically could knock you out of deep sleep and REM. Mm-hmm. So I don't know enough about it, but of the few studies I've seen, there's slightly more support for CBD versus THC.
Yeah, it seems like a mixed bag. I've had some patients who said it really works well, others it did not.
And again, individual differences, and we also can't underestimate the effectiveness of placebo. Placebo is the best and most reliable effect we have in medicine. So,
Yeah, okay. Any other major sleep myths that you'd like to tell us about that we haven't discussed?
Oh, yeah. This idea that we need to go to bed at the same time is mythological. Now, one thing that is important is waking up at the same time every day, creating an anchored wake-up time. Because your body rewards you for regularity with increased cognitive power, metabolic efficiency, and emotional regulation. So waking up at the same time every day is a must, even on weekends. Your body doesn't know the difference between a weekend and a weekday. That's a social contrivance. Wake up at the same time every day for health benefit. Now, this idea that you need to go to bed at the same time stems in part from waking up at the same time, you know, because we're on a 24-hour circadian rhythm. So the likelihood of going to bed at the same time increases if you wake up at the same time. But you only want to go to bed when you're sleepy, right? If you go to bed when you're tired, you might fall asleep, but you're probably going to wake up. So the only thing that you want to do is go to bed when you're noticing those behavioral symptoms of sleepiness. The other, I think, common myth I hear among patients is that they need 8 hours of sleep. The recommended dose of sleep varies according to age. So people over the age of 65 need 7 to 8. Infants need take the cake for needing the most. They need about, gosh, I think like 12 to 14. In general, you don't want less than 5. Mm-hmm. Most research studies describe that as sleep deprived.
Right.
But this idea that you must get 8 hours really is untrue. Mm-hmm. You need to know what's best for your body. Again, you wouldn't force hunger. Don't force sleep. So don't feel like you need the 8 hours. It really depends on age and individual preference.
Mm-hmm. So if you have, how do you know? So if you wake up and you have good energy throughout the day, you're probably getting enough sleep, right?
It's a really good question.
How do you know?
You know if, again, there's no distress and there's no functional impairment and these other indicators of metabolic health are present. So if you're gaining a lot of weight or if you're having difficulty losing weight, that could also be a sign that you're not getting enough sleep if your mood is dysregulated. So it really comes down to impairment and distress.
Speaking of metabolism, that's the next thing I wanted to ask you about was just sort of the link between sleep deprivation and metabolism and to the extent of metabolic syndrome.
Yeah, very, very well established relationship between sleep deprivation and metabolic dysregulation and probably through a host of mechanisms. But there are about 4 that really explain most of the variance. One, you know, the longer you're up, the more opportunities you have to eat. What we find is that people who get there was an experimental study done where people who were restricted to an hour and 20 minutes less of sleep actually ended up eating 600 calories more per day than people who didn't get restricted. So there are just more opportunities to eat. And we also know that the likelihood of eating more palatable, calorically dense food increases as the day goes on, and upwards of 35 to 40% of our calories, sometimes even higher, come after 6 p.m. So, and for any of you who are listeners who are in graduate school or who were in graduate school or who work night shift, think about what you ate when you pulled an all-nighter. You weren't binging on arugula. You were eating these calorically dense, highly palatable foods like pizza. So that's the first mechanism, is the longer you're up, the more opportunities you have to eat. The second mechanism that links sleep deprivation to metabolic dysfunction has to do with physiology. When we're sleep deprived, we see an increase in ghrelin, which is a hunger stimulating hormone, and a decrease in leptin, which is a hunger suppressant, an appetite suppressant. So there's an inverse relationship in the hormones that regulate our appetite in ways that are not helpful. We also see an increase in cortisol, that stress hormone, and increases in cortisol physiologically predict behavioral impulsivity. So when we're stressed out, we're much more likely to eat bad things or to opt for things that are convenient and processed rather than whole and nutritious. The third is this idea that our bodies compensate for poor sleep with highly caloric food. So the energy that your body doesn't get from sleep, it seeks out in food, particularly carbohydrate-dense fatty foods that confer these quick and dirty doses of energy, but then get your sugars rising and falling very quickly. And that is probably one of the primary mechanisms through which sleep deprivation can predict insulin resistance and metabolic dysfunction, metabolic syndrome. And last but not least, when we're sleep deprived, we totally have eroded motivation. It totally hijacks our motivation to engage in health behavior, like going to the gym or cooking. Mm-hmm. So when we're sleep deprived, we're much more likely to do things like rely on fast food, forego the gym, and much less likely to do things like make our own food, go to the gym, and make the healthier choice, right? Mm-hmm, so when we're sleep deprived, we're much more impulsive. We are much more likely to opt for the French fries rather than the salad. So when I work with patients trying to lose weight, the first thing I ask about is sleep, because there's no use in trying to lose weight if your sleep is dysregulated. It starts with that.
Yeah. I'm blessed to be on the faculty at the UAB and teach medical students, and I have a student here with me this week, and I was telling her the number one complaint I have from my patients is low energy. And energy affects everything in life. It affects what you eat and your work and your relationships. But I told her the first thing you have to do is get them sleeping. They'll never get their energy back till you get them a good night's sleep. So it's huge.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's a really complicated place to be, because so often people with insomnia are already so anxious, right? Generally, but especially about their sleep. So as a psychologist in training and someone who hopes to specialize in sleep medicine, I always have to be very careful about how I talk about sleep in a public way, because the goal is to inform and edify people, not to make them anxious. And so this public health message of get more sleep and you need to get more sleep is very well intentioned, but we have to make sure that we deliver it in a compassionate and helpful way. Otherwise, it can actually maintain some of the very anxiety that that causes and maintains insomnia.
Yeah, I know sometimes back when I was an ER doc, I'd say, okay, I've got a 12-hour shift coming up tomorrow. I've got to get sleep.
You know, right?
And
which
it
is paradoxical.
It creates this anxiety that would keep me awake.
And that's one of the exactly. And so often that's one of the presenting complaints I see in sleep clinic, this preoccupation with sleep. And one of the signs that you're getting good sleep is that it's not consuming your life, that sleep is not consuming your life. For people who don't get sleep, sleep has or the lack thereof has consumed them.
Yeah.
So one of the features or components of CBTI involves inventorying, paying attention to the attitudes and beliefs and thoughts you have about sleep that are not helpful, and developing strategies for challenging or accepting them so you can reduce your overall level of arousal at night and therefore get to sleep.
Mm. Speaking of arousal, what about sleep and sex? Is there any relationship between the two?
Of course.
Yeah, tell me all about that.
The common denominator is the bed, right?
There we go.
So again, going back to the 3S model, sleep, sex, and sickness.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what the bed's for. But of course, you can have sex in other places.
Right.
we'll have a separate podcast on that.
Right. That's coming up. Right.
But absolutely. And it goes back to what you said. You know, when we are sleep deprived, we are completely hijacked of our motivation. And sex is, while fun, requires
energy.
It requires planning. It requires initiation. And so if you aren't getting good sleep, mm-hmm. you're not going to be motivated mm-hmm. to have sex, or the quality and performance of that sex will be lackluster. And it's the same thing with exercise. You're much less likely to exercise. And if you do, the quality mm-hmm. of that exercise is significantly reduced. But the other mechanism, again, goes back to metabolic dysregulation. If you're not getting good sleep, you're increasing your risk for diabetes and metabolic syndrome and obesity, which can cause vascular issues, ED, and then vaginal dryness among among women. So definitely connected and beyond the common denominator of the bed.
right. In many ways. And Well, that is a wonderful segue into your sexy program. Tell us all about that.
Yeah, sexy. Oh, goodness. So sexy is the Senior Sex Education Experience Study. It's actually my dissertation, which is aiming to develop, implement, and evaluate the effectiveness of one of the first evidence-based sex ed protocols for people over the age of 50. We do I wouldn't say good job, but at least we have ways of educating younger people about sex, but we don't have very good tools for educating adults and older adults.
I defer with you. I think we do a lousy job of educating young people.
Yeah, we do. But at least there's something, I had a psych professor who always said, you know, if you had to be abused or neglected, you'd want to be abused because at least you got some attention. It's
right.
like, it's very much the same with,
for real, yeah,
well, that's
yeah.
very politically incorrect.
Yeah,
we don't want
right.
either of those things.
That's
but
right.
it's very much the same with this. There's absolutely very few resources empowering older adult sexuality and sexual citizenship. And so the purpose of this study is to create such a product. And so, you know, we're wrapping up focus groups and interviews now with older adults and physicians to help me inform, you know, the content of that educational protocol. And the next step will involve implementing and then evaluating the effects of it on improving sexual functioning, knowledge, and communication among older
adults. Speaking
of
communication and education, I'm going to take it aside here and say that we have a wonderful what I call sexual health support group here at the clinic, and Christina has been our guest many times, and our audience just loves to have her here. She's such a great speaker, and it's a great group of people who come. We meet once a month and talk about lots of issues having to do with sexuality, and everybody's invited, but most of them happen to be on the older end of the spectrum, and very interested in Christina's work. I think we sometimes have these preconceived notions what it means to be an older adult, and that automatically means we can't be sexual. So,
Absolutely. So
we're trying to fight against that that notion. Next, I'd love for you to tell us about the wonderful work you did with our good friend Dr. Christine Locken, who we miss dearly. And tell us about Christine, and also tell us about the wonderful work you did with her. And maybe it's tie into sleep.
Sure. So she's still with us. She just moved to
with us in spirit, right?
She's still, you know, it lives. She's in Washington,
if
Seattle.
If you're listening, Christine, we miss you and love you. Yes. But I know she's doing great work out there. She's with Dr. Ross, and they have a new clinic out there. I'll give them a shout out. The Brain Health and Research Institute. They're in Seattle, Washington, and doing amazing work.
They are doing amazing work.
We're very proud of Dr. Locken.
Yeah, we are. And so, you know, when Dr. Locken was here, we had the Brain Health Institute, was a precision neuropsychology clinic where people came for evidence-based evaluation of their cognition and physical and psychological health. And then we used those data to inform tailored psychosocial and behavioral medicine interventions.
And medical interventions,
that's right, with you and with other providers in the area. And so as part of that work, we created, as you know, you were instrumental in this, in creating individualized health plans for all of our patients. And in my role as the behaviorist, I worked on things related to sleep, emotional regulation, creating healthy habits, and monitoring depressive and anxious symptomology. And so, sleep played a major role in the interventions that we provided to those patients. Prior to Christine's leaving, we received a few seed grants from the Alzheimer's Foundation and Alzheimer's of Central Alabama to develop, implement, and evaluate the Brain Health Protocol, which was and is a psychosocial educational intervention aimed at providing people at risk for Alzheimer's and dementia with behavioral medicine principles for preventing and optimizing their cognitive functioning. And we're in the process of analyzing those data now.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any hint as far as what the data is going to show?
That eating good stuff is important,
right.
That sleeping is important, but also that having a sense of meaning and purpose.
That's huge. I talked about that to my patients all the time.
Yep.
And I see so many people are lacking purpose, especially, I hate to say, older adults, but sometimes young people as well, and that's huge.
Right? Absolutely. So, really the purpose of this beta, the pilot study, was to establish the feasibility of such a program and then to expand it out in subsequent iterations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, wonderful. You have so many things going on. Tell me about your blog.
Yeah. So my blog is called Engaging with Aging in Parentheses, mm-hmm. for Psychology Today. And I use that as a platform to sort of summarize and translate geropsychological and behavioral medicine to provide readers with practical takeaways that they can use to optimize their health and lifespans. My most recent piece, Why Wait? WEIGHT, Go to Sleep. Actually outlines the four mechanisms, or four of many mechanisms, through which sleep dysregulation can cause metabolic issues. But I use that space to talk about sex and aging, exercise and aging, sleep and aging, my own attitudes and beliefs towards aging, how studying aging has changed my attitudes and beliefs towards aging itself. So it's a space for me to explore and play, but to also provide products to lay audiences about how they can optimize their health and lifespans. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not going to ask you how old you are, but on the other hand, it's really I do as an older guy myself. I really appreciate the fact that you, as a young person, are taking interest in us old codgers, because we need it. So
well,
thank you very much.
Absolutely, and you know, one of the things I talk about on the blog is how I got interested in aging, and one of the best predictors of entry into gerontological vocations is positive and consistent exposure to older adults, and that very much describes my story. All throughout my life, I had several wonderful older adults, family members and non-family members alike, who modeled for me and to me the privilege and beauty of human aging. And another thing that I think we've talked about in the past that I think really has a lot of clinical value relies less on evaluating chronological age and more on subjective age. So asking mm-hmm. patients how mm-hmm. old they feel, we believe mm-hmm. that actually predicts more variance in health outcome than chronological age.
Yeah. And one thing I talk about to my patients, I met this guy one time. I was down at Dolphin Island camping out down there, and I ran into a guy. He was 82 years old, and he's biking across America from California to Florida. And well, it's such a wonderful paradigm of aging. And I thought to myself, you know, how can I be in that group? Because most of us by 82, we're dead, we're in the nursing home, we're in the rocking chair. And if you can sort of have that kind of paradigm, that you can be doing those kind of things at 82, that's really very
powerful.
And we
can. And
yeah, we can.
This is is like the best time to be alive.
That's right. For sure. And finally, we'd love to hear about your forthcoming book.
Oh, well.
Tricks Aren't Just for Kids.
So I can't take credit for coming up with that incredibly clever title. My colleague and friend, Dr. Beth DiNapoli, and I are working on this book that, frankly, has been backburnered as I just complete my residency at UAB and finish up my dissertation. But the goal of this is to kind of share the science and stories of sex after 60, which weaves together clinical anecdotes as well as some evidence-based research about sexuality in later life, committed to disabusing readers of myths and educating people about the opportunities and benefits of aging as it relates to sexual satisfaction and functioning. What we know is that subjectively, people describe their sex lives as better than ever in the third act of life.
For sure.
And we want to use this book as a way of celebrating and announcing that to the world.
And by the way, it's a very clever play on words. It's a Trix, T-R-I-X-X-X.
Triple X.
It's a triple X.
We might even capitalize the X's.
Yeah, there we go.
Have a naked picture of Jane Fonda on the cover or something.
There we go. So, okay. Well, finally, Christina, tell the audience how they might contact you or follow your amazing work.
Oh, that's very sweet. Let's see. If you just Google Christina Pierre Paoli Parker, P as in Peter, I-E-R, P as in Peter, A-O-L-I, you'll get directed to my blog. You can find me on different social media platforms at The Age Ambassador. And again, my blog for Psychology Today is called Engaging.
Well, Christina, it's been wonderful to have you here on the podcast. You're the only one I know who talks as fast as I do.
Excellent. So. Northern pride.
Yeah, I moved here from Boston. You're from Jersey. So yeah. Anyway, we can at least understand each other,
Simpatico.
Can't we?
Yeah.
Now, Ben, you might have to slow down this podcast for the rest of the audience. So, well, that will about do it for this episode of the Functional Medicine Podcast. Thank you so much for joining
us.
And we hope we were able to share something with you that was helpful to you. Don't forget to check us out at functionalmedicinepodcast.com. And you can also go to mcminnclinic.com. And please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. And want to give a shout out here to Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
He does our recording, makes this all happen for us. Thank you so much, Ben. And if you have any questions for us or topics you'd like to hear about, then please contact us. You can just go to our website, functionalmedicinepodcast.com. I think there's a little box there. You can leave a comment. So anyway, we usually have Coach Lindsay leave a pearl of wisdom, and she's not here today. Once again, she's home with her wonderful little baby. So I'm going to do my best. I'm never as good as Lindsay is. But my pearl of wisdom is that if you want to get optimized, it's all about the fundamentals. And if you'll go to, once again, the website, look up the Pyramid of Wellness, and they are the simple things of nutrition, hydration, exercise, restorative sleep, weight management, stress management, spiritual and emotional wellness, social relationships, and intimacy. So just focus on those things, and that's your best path to optimal wellness. It's not going to be by taking some amazing new pill.
Right.
Well, that will wrap it up. Once again, thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you, Dr. McMahon.
And
how
we miss
much
you,
fun.
Coach Lindsay. And once again, a shout out to Dr. Locken, and y'all take care. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Over and out from McMahon Clinic.